I'm not very smart, not very technical. And so all these complex issues, man, I hear one side and I hear the other side, and I just have to decide who I trust more, I guess, if I was to try to come up with a decision, like who I should be following. So I just try not to. If people ask me, I'm just like, phew. But again, I'm a journalist, so that should be good, right? That I don't have a position. So when it was, the strange thing happened that I was invited to moderate this. I was more surprised than anybody. I said yes, and then the organizer said, okay, have you looked at the site? Are you sure? And I was like, oh, of course. What, I'm coming to Netherlands, hosting a Bitcoin conference? How could I say no? And then I started looking, and I was like, wait a second. There's kind of a slant here to this. I don't know if this is quite an impartial thing. And I started really, what did I just sign up for? Is this going to hurt my credibility, if I have credibility as a impartial journalist? And, you know, I've had people everywhere from, you know, Peter Todd and Samson Mao to JVP and Bitcoin Jesus himself. So I really do want to remain open to all sides. So I guess I just want to make sure that, you know, I want you all to love me. I want to make sure this isn't seen like I am somehow aligned with basically, I mean, this is all the groups here, I feel like, that hate Bitcoin Core. And I mean, does that, I don't know. Okay. Don't hate Bitcoin Core. Just a little annoyed by, I mean, I have to admit, Adam Back I thought was a pretty cool dude, but he's gotten a little trollish lately on Twitter. I mean, he didn't used to be quite as, just, yeah. So, and it's tough because at this conference, at any conference, everybody seems about the same to me. You all seem as nice as any other people. Everyone seems super nice. And everything I'm hearing, again, I'm not that smart, sounds very reasonable. You know, SegWit people, they're like, I mean, that sounds reasonable. SegWit is going to die. I mean, I hear people, I've heard both opinions because we've got some small blockers here too about what happens when the chain splits, like very dramatic differences of opinion. And since everyone who's giving me those opinions is so much smarter than me, I'm just, I have no idea. But just to kind of be a little bit more equal here, I wanted to put this on. I am impartial. I don't know anything. I'm not a big blocker or a small blocker. I'm just the MC. I did not organize this event. So I just wanted to make sure I can still be a journalist. Yes, small blockers, go ahead, get the picture with me on here. Big blockers, forget you saw that. And I actually reached out to Jameson before this because I felt like, okay, he's someone I can kind of hold on to, as maybe values were a little bit different than everybody else's here. So I actually reached out to him and told him, I'm glad you'll be here, Jameson. And so our next speaker is Jameson Lopp.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. It's great to be here at the Future of Bitcoin. Now, the motto for this conference is discovering Bitcoin's future. And I think that that is on point. Now, as I have extensively argued in my writings, it may not be possible for any of us to fully understand this system. And it may not be possible for us to steer it onto the path that we want it to go on. We're really all just learning about the system as we go along. Regardless of what point you may be on this understanding Bitcoin curve, we're all huddled together on a life raft in an ocean of financial turmoil, and we're just trying to figure out how the hell we build it into a battle cruiser. So we all know where the story begins. On an obscure cryptography mailing list in 2008, someone using the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto sent an email with a white paper, and he said, I've been working on a new electronic cash system that's fully peer-to-peer with no trusted third party. And Satoshi was far from the first person to propose an electronic cash system. Many of the cypherpunks on this list had grown weary of the slew of failed attempts over the decades. Many of those who responded to Satoshi poked and prodded at the proposal, claiming it could never work in practice due to fundamentally flawed assumptions around the scalability or the game theory of the system itself. the names of those first few respondents to Satoshi will be lost to history, while the name of the man who responded differently shall never be forgotten, Hal Finney. Where most cypherpunks cynically saw only the potential for failure, he saw the potential for success. Never mind that Hal had previously devised his own system of digital cash called reusable proof of work, which was also based upon Hashcash. He was focused on the big picture. Bitcoin seems to be a very promising and original idea, he said. I'm looking forward to seeing how the concept is further developed. Hal realized that he had once thought that similar systems would also fail for the same reasons that others were thinking Bitcoin was going to fail, but he was wrong and wasn't going to make that mistake again. Hal cooperated with Satoshi over the coming months. He found many bugs in Satoshi's code and fixed them. He mined many Bitcoins with his CPU and received the first ever Bitcoin transaction that was sent peer-to-peer. Hal went a step beyond simply being an adversary to Bitcoin proposal. He brought a builder's mindset to the game. Now, I bring this all up today because I see many Bitcoiners acting like the first respondents to Satoshi, overly pessimistic from years of adversarial thinking and frustration. Now, when you're involved in public discourse about the future of Bitcoin, I hope that you'll ask yourself, what would Hal do? Several years ago, Balaji Srinivasan gave an introduction to Bitcoin presentation in which he stated that Bitcoin mining is a coopetition, when what he meant by this was that Bitcoin miners are simultaneously competing 24/7, 365 to find the next valid block, and they are also cooperating to secure and extend the same blockchain. This got me to thinking, perhaps we've been going about this all wrong. Perhaps we've been focused on the wrong things and fallen into a trap of our own making. And by being too focused on competition and throwing cooperation out the window, we are missing opportunities to grow this ecosystem. So I make no claims to being an expert in game theory. I only got interested in this concept a few months ago. But my understanding is that every game is comprised of the same few basic elements. And today I'll mostly be talking about players and rules in respect to this game that we call Bitcoin. As Craig noted yesterday, Bitcoin is not a democracy. Bitcoin is not an oligarchy. It's not even left-leaning anarchy. It's capitalism. And the four types of players in games of capitalism are customers, suppliers, competitors, and complementers. It's important to realize that none of the players in a game are fixed. An effective strategy may entail bringing in new players or pushing out existing ones. For example, if you only have one supplier, you might want to pay for other suppliers to enter the game in order to make new material for your markets cheaper. And you may want to commoditize those products. On the other hand, if you're considering becoming a new player to a game as a supplier, you should actually try to get compensated up front by your future customers because you're bringing competition into the game and you're going to be saving the existing players, customers, a lot of money. So within this player's element, we can actually use the concept of the value net to express the relations between the players. And the value net is a way to explain the interdependencies between players in a game. Now, there, as you can see, are both vertical and horizontal components to this value net. Vertically, it demonstrates that users or customers and suppliers are both value creators. Now, organizations should listen to the needs of both players in order to maximize the value of the system. Horizontally, you see that competitors and complementers are exact mirror images of each other. And customers will value your product more when there are many complementers, whereas they will value your product less when there are many competitors because they act as substitutors. Now, understanding this relationship highlights a deficiency in common competitive practices, which is the business as war concept, where you only focus on eliminating and outcompeting your competitors. Instead of thinking of it this way, organizations should also try to develop commodity complementers where the long-term value of the system will be increased overall. So by understanding these two symmetries, we can use this type of value net model to give us a greater potential for understanding the game theory and successfully applying new strategies. Instead of only focusing on the conventional players like customers and competitors, we can see that there are actually four different strategies that we can target. So I brainstormed a bit, just trying to think about some of the different players that are in Bitcoin's value net. And this is by no means a comprehensive list, and I hope that, in fact, some of you may be able to contribute additional ideas to it so that we can improve our understanding of Bitcoin's game theory. For users, this is a tough one. They add value to the system by creating demand and by, in our case, increasing the network effect. But because there are potentially so many use cases for Bitcoin, we could say that potential users are everyone in the world, or at least everyone above a certain age. So other people that we could be targeting, the unbanked. We could be targeting people who are seeking shelter from hyperinflation. We could be targeting people who are seeking financial privacy and censorship resistance. We could be targeting high-risk speculators, entrepreneurs who want to build on the platform. Of course, we could be targeting libertarians and anarchists who want freedom from the control of state and central banks. Suppliers, on the other hand, they increase value by adding resources to the system. Some examples that came to mind: developers who write software, thus adding utility to the Bitcoin ecosystem. Miners who are providing their hardware and capital and electricity resources to securing the system from computational attack. Full nodes who are essentially validating data, replicating data, enforcing consensus rules on the network. And traders and market makers who are providing liquidity to markets and hopefully, as we go along, continuing to increase and stabilize the exchange rates. With competitors, these are entities that decrease the value of a system by acting as substitutes. So on a similar vein, because Bitcoin could be used for so many things, you could say there are also quite a few different competitors, some obvious ones being fiat money, other payment rails like credit cards and wire transfers, precious metals, other stores of value, other crypto assets, of course, central banks, or even if we're thinking of Bitcoin as a new type of economic voluntary interaction system where we're getting rid of authorities, we could consider all authorities, rule creators, and rule enforcers to be potential competitors to this system. On the complementary side, these are entities that increase value by bundling extra utility on Bitcoin. That would be things such as consumer apps, other use cases, wallets, tumblers, even non-monetary applications like notarization and timestamping services. And of course, merchants accepting Bitcoin, especially unique merchants such as darknet markets. And second layer networks could bring completely new types of utility onto Bitcoin. So an interesting revelation that I had from looking at the value net is that there are three different player types that we could target without threatening any competitors and still increase the value of the system. So I pose to you that there may in fact be many opportunities by targeting those three player types that will be easier and offer a greater return on our investment. Remember, we are tiny. We are vastly outnumbered and outcapitalized by our competitors at this point. We've heard things like Bitmain, Blockstream, Enchain, many other entities in this space who have raised hundreds of millions of dollars, which is great. They have war chests, but that's still a drop in the bucket compared to what we're facing. I pose to you that we do not want strong competitors to feel threatened by Bitcoin until it's too late for them to respond. The crypto asset industry is in competition, not just with itself and with alternate coins, but we're in competition with many, many industries. One example, we're in competition with the entire high-tech industry over a very limited supply of software engineers and talent. As such, we should be trying to develop and foster a welcoming community for these developers. And I would point to Ethereum as a potential model to follow in that regard. They seem to be doing pretty well on the developer side. speaking of developers. In terms of the developers, we already see coopetition happening amongst developers on a single team. Unlike corporate software development, there are no project managers or architects passing down feature requirements from on high. Instead, we have multiple developers who may propose similar competing changes that attempt to solve the same perceived problems in a system. If a proposal begins to gain traction, other developers would jump in, probe the idea for weaknesses, and then eventually decide to cooperate with a proposer to go ahead and improve it. On a related note, I've observed a fundamental conflict between how the vast majority of software development occurs versus how public consensus networks operate. So most software developers take the approach of envisioning the system how they want it to be. They then write the code that will create that functionality and those rules and then deploy it. But in Bitcoin, you have some developers who take this approach historically with not a lot of success in the past few years. You have other groups of developers who consider the existing rules of the system to be constraints within they have to work in order to be able to deploy changes. And that methodology has historically tended to be more successful. Now, I'm sure that this is a particularly contentious point amongst many of you, and many of you have changes that you desire to see implemented in Bitcoin, and you have been frustratingly failing to activate them. Perhaps we can just dismiss this as another inefficiency of a decentralized system, but it seems to me that this, in the long term, could potentially have a chilling effect upon development and result in a lot of wasted resources that end up never actually getting used. I myself am a former Bitcoin XT supporter. I know full well the feeling of seeing months of work and waiting go up in smoke. I hope that we can break out of the cycle of failed initiatives. A plethora of businesses based upon Bitcoin and its platform have emerged over the years, and many of them are in direct competition with each other because they have customers seeking to fill the same specific use cases. Yet many of these businesses are forming partnerships and trade services with each other, and they're doing this in order to form mutually beneficial relationships that leverage the strengths of each business. I can tell you that this is certainly true at BitGo, as we wish to provide our services to as many different people in the ecosystem as possible. It's clear to me that the root cause in the rift of the scaling debate is conflicting needs between different types of Bitcoin users and their use cases. And enterprises that service some of these users, especially those who are transacting in smaller value amounts, are feeling the pressure to improve their customers' experience. As a result, many of them are trying to change the rules of the Bitcoin game. But other players in the game consider this rule change to be hazardous to the value of their own use cases. Due to the strength of the status quo in Bitcoin, we find ourselves at an impasse. People within the ecosystem are broadcasting their thoughts across mailing lists, forums, chat rooms, and social media. They argue about the nature of Bitcoin, the direction it can go, and they're trying to earn respect and social capital and group other people behind their cause. Unfortunately, this process has degenerated over the past several years, and tribalism has taken a toll on the community. It has fractured discussion. Many devs have left the Bitcoin mailing list to avoid drama and harassment. I've been tracking mailing list activity, and it's been on the decline for quite a while. I think that one of the greatest problems is the classification of people as small blockers, large blockers, or a number of more derogatory names that are being slung around. This is a very nuanced discussion, and we should avoid grouping people based upon some similar viewpoints. In fact, I think it is best if we stop talking about people and start talking and focusing on ideas. The vitriol, the tribalism, this has all led to communication breakdowns. I've lost count of how many times I've had someone message me privately to tell me that they won't be participating in a conversation because they've blocked or muted or ignored some of the primary participants. The blocking has even gotten to the point of causing more misunderstandings. Take, for example, a recent Twitter blunder where Alice attacked Bob because Bob was saying that he thought Bitcoin needed a CEO. But Bob was actually arguing against Bitcoin needing a CEO, and Alice lost the context because Charlie had blocked her. Thus, entire portions of the tweet thread were missing, and the meaning of the conversation drastically changed. In this situation, no one is to blame, and yet everyone is to blame. Similar problems have happened on the Bitcoin subreddit, where the removal of comments by moderators combined with complex CSS rules automatically expanded collapsed, removed threads that also caused portions of conversation to mysteriously disappear imperceptibly, changing the meaning of the conversation. I speak from personal experience here as someone who has had posts removed from our Bitcoin, as someone who has been attacked by trolls on every platform I've used, been banned from our Bitcoin for posting inconvenient facts, and even as the moderator of the Bitcoin XT subreddit. I consider every Bitcoin-specific forum to be flawed, and this is because they all tend to be skewed due to the tribalism of either the moderators or the users, who are nearly guaranteed to have some sort of vested interest in seeing their own vision of Bitcoin promoted. That's why these days you'll mainly find me on Twitter, because no one is stifling my speech there. It seems to me that back when we were all using the same few forums, we were doing a better job at fostering competition. But now the focus on competition has divided the community and wasted our most valuable resource, time. Remember what Anthony spoke about yesterday. Cooperation increases value, and value can foster increased cooperation, creating a virtuous cycle. If you spew vitriol at your fellow Bitcoiners online, you aren't just hurting your target. You are indirectly hurting us all. I mentioned that this presentation was inspired by a reference to mining coopetition, though at this point I think it's worth digging a little bit deeper into the example so that we might compare it to the other forms of coopetition already covered. In the early days, folks were solo mining with CPUs and GPUs, but it didn't take them long to figure out that they were cooperating and pooling resources to offer a more consistent return. So this pooled mining concept also expanded the crypto economy by creating business opportunities for people with the operational skills to maintain a reliable and trustworthy pool. Good times for everyone. As you're surely aware, there are a handful of companies that now control a significant portion of Bitcoin's hashing power. You're also aware that in any entity that gains a majority of hashing power, or possibly less with selfless mining strategies, can effectively control the blocks that get added to the tip of the blockchain over a long period of time. So it's not a stretch to imagine that a handful of mining companies could communicate in private and decide to form a cartel by working together to orphan all the blocks being mined by entities outside of the cartel. This could shut out the rest of the competition and thus split the pie amongst a smaller number of people, giving them larger slices, larger fees, and block rewards. And Nicola recently made an economic argument that logically this could cause mining to devolve into a duopoly. So why don't we see this cartelization happening? I pose to you that it's because miners know that Bitcoin is more valuable when they're building on top of each other's work, rather than just throwing away large amounts of work for a short-term gain. Miners are cooperating to secure and extend the same blockchain. If some miners change the protocol to be incompatible with the rest, and the blockchain forks as a result, these two sets of miners are no longer in coopetition. They are merely in competition. And this drastically changes the game theory and equilibrium of the system by also reducing security, because it's now computationally cheaper to attack each chain fork separately. And this is but one of many reasons why we should be cautious to avoid contentious forks of all kinds. Bitcoin is a very interesting game. None of us are being forced to play. We all have our own incentives for playing. But I think that a fundamental disconnect between the different sides of this debate is that they're playing different games. And those who view Bitcoin as digital gold and accept a trade-off of higher transaction fees in return for a lower cost of full blockchain validation, they believe that the rules of the protocol are intentionally hard to change and that we should work within the confines of the rules to improve the system scalability without compromising forward compatibility. On the other hand, those who view Bitcoin more as a payment system that needs to have low transaction fees in order to be competitive and reach mass adoption, they believe that the rules of the system must change in order for it to evolve and increase in utility and value. Neither of these views is necessarily wrong. They're just different games. It's a lot harder to foster coopetition when you're not playing the same game. Is it possible that this is an irreconcilable difference? Sure. I completely agree with what Peter said in his talk, that Bitcoin is fundamentally based upon ideology. We are just using science to bring our ideology into reality by running fully validating nodes that automatically enforce the rules that we, the node operators, agree with. But I hope that you agree with me that the game of Bitcoin is more fun and more valuable when it has more players. Should Bitcoin endure a permanent chain split, I fear it would set a precedent for more fracturing in the future, causing further loss of network effect and greater confusion over the identity of Bitcoin for users who are trying to decide what they want. With regard to rule changes, I think it's also worth looking at how the competition ends up being affected. I pose to you that any rule change Bitcoin implements can also be made by its competition in the crypto ecosystem. If Bitcoin can change to use huge blocks, what's to stop Litecoin or Ethereum or any other open blockchain system from doing the same in response? I suspect that changing the protocol to target low on-chain transaction fees will result in a cryptocurrency price war with a race to the bottom, and price wars tend to end in Pyrrhic victories. Now, if you're not familiar with the Cypherpunk Manifesto, I recommend giving it a read. While privacy is but one of the many aspects of this ecosystem that is integral to it, I believe that the spirit of coopetition rings true in the Cypherpunk Manifesto that Eric Hughes wrote years ago. I find these excerpts to be particularly relevant. Cypherpunks write code. We know that someone has to write software to defend privacy, and since we can't get privacy unless we all have it, we're going to write it. We publish our code so that our fellow cypherpunks may play with it and practice, and our code is free for all to use worldwide. For privacy to be widespread, it must be part of a social contract. People must come together to deploy these systems for the greater good. Privacy only extends so far as the cooperation of one's fellows in society. And we, the cypherpunks, we seek your questions. We seek your concerns. And we hope that we may engage you so that we do not deceive ourselves. Bitcoin was born from the efforts of cypherpunks. Cypherpunks knew the value of coopetition. I know there's a lot of bad blood in this space, and you may be tempted to attack individuals who have offended you. But let's not waste energy perpetuating a vicious cycle. Yes, this is an adversarial environment, but in order to foster a constructive adversarial environment, it must be adversarial in the intellectual sense, not the emotional sense. We have too much left to build, and we can't afford to spend the time over petty squabbles. What would HAL do? In highly segmented industries with strong network effects, such as the tech industry, coopetition may be the only way to avoid stagnation. In fact, it is often difficult in the tech industry to get new products off the ground. The market demands technical standards before it can adopt anything at a mainstream level. But it can take years of fruitless cutthroat competition that inhibits the overall growth of the system before a clear winner emerges. Coopetition can help us avoid that by finding win-win scenarios. And I'm sure you've all seen this chart plenty of times, the tech adoption life cycle. Personally, I think we're still way on the left side there in the innovation phase. Coopetition can be an extremely valuable strategy for technology dependent upon network effects when they're still trying to bootstrap. Since the early market is small, competing for market share does not make much sense. Instead, in the early market stage, we should focus on creating demand and getting past the chasm or the tipping point. Coopetition can create win-win situations for everyone involved and, in fact, get us closer and lower the tipping point for reaching mainstream adoption. If we accept the premise that we don't have resources to quickly ramp up the entire ecosystem for mainstream adoption, how do we find the path forward? I'd argue that once you convince someone to own and store value in Bitcoin, they are incentivized to use their skills and resources to help make the system more valuable. In this manner, we can bootstrap the system organically. And what if, instead of targeting low-value use cases during the bootstrapping phase, we adopt a Tesla-esque strategy? That is, court the wealthiest of entities to be early adopters in this system. Incentivize them to pay for the hard work, the innovation of the ecosystem. This could be high net worth individuals, hedge funds, even tiny nation states with currencies already dwarfed by Bitcoin. Last I checked, there were 140 countries whose M1 money supplies were less than Bitcoin's money supply. Surely, some of them have far more to gain than to lose by taking a first mover advantage in the global transition to crypto assets. The tricky part here is that Bitcoin does not have a marketing department. It's up to each of us to spread it like a mind virus. We would need to find people already in the community who can build bridges to these high-value networks that we wish to target. If you think you fit this criterion or are interested in the idea, please contact me. Now, yesterday, Jihan mentioned that there's an incentive problem with development. Many contributors are unpaid volunteers. So what if, instead of relying upon a poorly defined process for funding protocol development with a scattering of grants and a scattering of companies that are paying for their own developers, we instead created some sort of multi-sig fund where enterprisers and high net worth investors contribute to and control in order to hire full-time protocol devs and or post bounties for feature development? I don't think that an idea like this needs to be baked into the protocol itself, as some cryptocurrencies have done. These are just a few random thoughts. There are certainly many more unexplored possibilities that are still out there. I suppose what I'm really trying to say is that we need to play a long-term game. We aren't building a technology that we want to take down a path that causes it to fail or become obsolete in a decade, like those Radio Shack products that Andrew showed us yesterday. We're building a system that must last for generations. The lifespan of the average fiat currency is 27 years. Imagine the global confidence that Bitcoin will acquire if we can exceed that mark. I'm confident that we can, and we'll find safe ways to take us down the path to mass adoption. All that is required is creativity and perseverance. Now, there's a famous quote by Herbert Swope that states, "I cannot give you the formula for success, but I can give you the formula for failure, which is try to please everyone." Bitcoin clearly cannot be everything we all want it to be at this stage. Otherwise, we risk it becoming nothing any of us want it to be. We're currently working with what amounts to a very small pie. Many of you are rightfully frustrated because you're watching use cases get priced out of Bitcoin, effectively shrinking the slices of the pie. You may feel powerless to stop portions of Bitcoin's user base from defecting to other crypto assets. For your own peace of mind, I recommend letting go of your anger and frustration. Accept that Bitcoin is beyond your control, and instead focus on figuring out the things that you can control with regard to Bitcoin's value net. That is how we can grow this pie. We can always compete later over how to slice up the pie. When developers, businesses, and users switch from coopetition to competition, it makes us all weaker. The great thing about coopetition is that it allows us to leverage free market capitalism to accelerate innovation while still retaining the strengths afforded to us by network effects. And as Craig said yesterday, it doesn't matter how much we may hate each other. We're all in the same boat together. And as I see it, we're all huddled on a life raft in an ocean of financial turmoil. Instead of waging war with one another and splintering the raft, let's build a warship so that we may raid the coffers of the overconfident bankers in their overladen galleons. My fellow Bitcoiners, I look forward to cooperating with you for many years to come. Vires in numeris. Thank you.
All right, is the tossable mic back there somewhere? All right, anyone have some questions? Let's start in the back. Can you give it to the guy back there? Thanks.
Hey, very good talk, by the way. There is two things that you said that seems to be somewhat in opposition these days. So I would like, if you can expand on it a bit, that'd be great. So this is the idea that we shouldn't fork because it weakens the community and the strength of the coins and the security and all of that. On the other hand, you say that a sure way to fail is try to please everybody. And right now, the solution to avoid the fork seems to be SegWit 2x, which is trying to do exactly that. So I would like for you to expand a bit on that subject, if you can.
Right. We should fork. We should fork as much as we possibly can without shedding off too much of the ecosystem. And I think what the contention comes down to is, how do you measure the contention? How do you measure how many people you're going to lose by making some sort of change? Now, it just so happens that historically we've managed to do a lot of soft forks where we didn't lose really anyone perceptibly. There was, you know, one hard fork a long time ago where some miners tried to keep giving themselves 50 bitcoins for every block reward, and that didn't last very long. But on the hard fork side, I think the problem is, because it's ideological, that you do have some people on the extremes who, regardless of which direction you're going to go, are going to steadfastly say, I'm staying here, you can't make me do anything. So can we please everyone in that regard? No. We have to cut some of the fat, as it were, for the greater good. And it's unfortunate, but a consensus system like this, you can go for, you know, a super majority of whatever metric you want to use, but you'll never be able to get 100%. You know, we've just got too many people, too much diversity in the ecosystem to make everybody happy with the change. And so while from a technical standpoint, sure, maybe we can soft fork SegWit, and a lot of people will be really, really unhappy about having SegWit in the system, but at least we can't force SegWit upon anyone. No one can force you to create those addresses, receive money into a wallet that you think may be less secure. So, I mean, I would like to see hard forks happen in the future as well. I have always been a big blocker from that standpoint. I think that second layer solutions are magnifiers, and you need to have a larger base layer in order for your magnifier to work better. But I have my own opinions, and I guess I straddle both sides, and I catch flack from a lot of people. But at the end of the day, I guess I have adopted this Zen outlook, and that, you know, Bitcoin will continue in one form or another, and maybe there will be multiple Bitcoins. No one can stop anybody from leaving. If you believe that you have a use case that is going to be more valuable and have more utility, then we can't stop you from doing whatever you want to do. So the question becomes, do you have the incentives to stay with the rest of us, or do you believe that you can overcome the loss of network effect from leaving?
All right, any other questions? All right, up here. Here you go.
Thank you. So when you talk about not being able to, you talk about a we, as in there's like, we need to push SegWits, mm-hmm. but it's really asking the authority who controls the rules. So the developer, there is no we pushing SegWits, there's the developers asking the miners to implement it for them. But just to get onto the network effect, I think you said we might lose people if we hard fork. But I would say, if you look at the empirical evidence, we've lost a lot more people by not hard forking. When you look at all the adoption that's happening outside of the network and all the people that are selling Bitcoin and now promoting altcoins, what do you think of that?
Yeah, and if we want to compete, you know, with those use cases, then we would need much larger block sizes. We'd need to have much lower transaction fees. And it's certainly an option. I cannot stand up here and tell you that, like, Craig Wright and Peter Risen are wrong. I believe it's certainly possible that we could have, you know, gigabyte block sizes and try to suck as much of the global transaction volume as possible onto blockchains and just have, you know, really high expensive nodes that are doing high volume
stuff.
Let's
just keep with $50 nodes and 8 megabyte blocks.
Sure. So we go to the extreme of like $20,000 nodes, and then the other extreme we have $5 Raspberry Pis. And this ultimately comes down to what is the right cost We're doing this trade-off of the cost of a transaction fee versus the cost of full validation. And I don't have the authority to tell you what the optimal cost of that is. And I think that we have completely missed the ability to find a consensus on this cost of node operation metric or cost of transaction metric. It would be great if we could have some science. I think I postulated a year ago in an article that we could come up with some multi-dimensional matrix algorithm to determine a cost of full node validation and then try to target that, you know, as technology continues to improve. But then we'd just be bike shedding over what the actual targeted cost should be. So I wish that I could stand up here and tell you, like, this is what the cost of this should be, and this is what the cost of that should be. But then I would basically be devolving into the role of central banker. And we just have to figure that out ourselves.
Great, thanks. And on the topic of cooperation or
co-competition.
Co-competition. you mentioned spurring vitriol and creating adverse environments. What do you say to dropping grenades on cooperating competition?
Yeah, so there are adversarial issues that have, you know, come up in the technical side of things, of like exploiting various problems in software that have caused a lot of people to get upset and believe that the good faith in the development process has broken down. On that standpoint, I would say the most that you can really do is either ignore people who are being unnecessarily vitriolic or you believe are, you know, sucking your time up and not cooperating, not providing meaningful feedback and value to what we're trying to do as a system. Or you can go the method of trying to call them out and yell at them and try to get other people to band behind you to say, you know, we all need to shout this person down. And I've tried both of these. And whenever I've tried to shame someone or shout them down for being unnecessarily vitriolic, then I just get flack from the other side that, why am I supporting, you know, this particular person? So unfortunately, I've really found, like, being silent and ignoring bad behavior to be the best option for me.
All right, any other questions? All right, we're going to be ahead of schedule. All right, thanks, Jameson.